So let me first thank the organizers for accepting my application to come here, in spite of the fact that I've never done anything related to pattern formation. I have done something related to biology, so in that sense it overlapped with the tema of this workshop. So I will speak about contact mechanics, adhesion, and rubber friction I will not speak about. And I will give you some application to biology towards the end of my talk related to the adhesion part. And what I'm interested of is understanding how leaf fibers can work on a vertical wall, or a fly can work on a window. And recent experiments have shown that the adhesive interaction between the fingers on the leaf fiber, for example, and the flat, smooth wall is very strong. And you can, in fact, hang 4 kilograms in a leaf fiber, which is only 20 grams heavy.
And did
they
do that?
They haven't done an experiment exactly like that, but they've taken one finger of the leaf fiber and pushed it against a smooth wall and removed it and measured the force.
And multiplied by two.
Yeah. Of course, this means that the adhesive system is strongly overbuilt, you might think. But the point is that leaf fiber must also be able to move on a very rough stone wall, and in that case, adhesion is much reduced.
You just mentioned this, so was it alive, the finger of the
wall? Yes, yeah, alive, yeah. Just for fun, I want to point out that if you scale up this to size of human beings, because here the contact area is only about 1 square millimeter for each finger. And if you have a human being with maybe 1 square centimeter of contact area, it means that these things which you see sometimes in movies could really happen. Maybe somewhere else in our universe you will have some objects moving around on very smooth walls in the size of human beings. So my first part of my talk will be about contact mechanics, which is maybe not so familiar to most physicists, but very familiar to engineers, which have to worry about this kind of problem almost every day. And just there's a huge number of applications of contact mechanics. Let me just mention a few points here. For example, if you bring two metallic bodies together and you measure the resistivity to make a current flow between them, is determined by the contact region, because the current has to flow only through this contact region here. The same if you look at the heat transfer, you heat up one block and you look at the heat transfer to the other block, most of the heat transfer has to come through this real contact here. At least if you look at low temperature, and you can forget about the blackbody radiation between the surfaces here. And this is well known in the low temperature community. They want to have very good heat transfer from one block to another block, and they had to squeeze them together with very big forces. Another important engineering application is in the context of sealing. You have, for example, in a tire, you have high pressure inside and low pressure outside, and you don't want the gas to leak out. And that's possible only if you don't have too big spaces between the two surfaces. And what got me into contact mechanics originally was that I worked on rubber friction. And basically all materials which I'm going to tell you about is spin-off products of my work on rubber friction. In rubber friction, for example, a tire sliding on a road, the road has roughness on many different length scales. A little schematic picture here. A spirit is of different size. The rubber block is sliding on top of that. And during sliding, these asperities will exert pulsating deformations in the rubber. And because of the internal friction in the rubber, you will get energy dissipation inside the rubber here. And that's the main origin of rubber friction. It's a bulk property of the rubber, depending also on the surface roughness of the substrate. And in order to calculate that, you need to be able to describe the contact between the road surface and the tire on all length scale, from microscopic size down to much shorter length scale, because of the fact that you have asperities of all sizes. Now, what turned out to make this problem very interesting for a theoretician like myself is that it involves many different length scales. So if you take a normal surface, it has roughness on microscopic length scale, but also on atomistic length scale. So you might have 8 decades of length scale, which is important. And in this talk, or in the approach I have to contact mechanics, also to adhesion, I'm speaking about looking at the interface at different magnifications. So suppose we have, for example, a rubber block squeezed against a rough substrate here. And we look at it at very low magnification, which means bad resolution, long length scale, then it looks like we have contact in some region and not contact in other region. But when we magnify one of these regions where it looks like we have contact, then it turns out that we can observe new area of non-contact, because this surface here has roughness on shorter length scale. And then we might magnify another region which looks like we have perfect contact here, but when we increase the resolution, the contact becomes smaller. And one can show mathematically that if you would have roughness over basically infinite many length scale, the true contact area between these two solids would be zero, independent of how much you squeeze them together, independent of the force, assuming that everything behaves elastically and not no plastic yielding. So in that case, you will get the finite contact area in practice only because you have a lower cutoff determined by atomic dimension.
Well, then you're making some assumption about the way things are scaling.
In this argument, I assume you have roughness on all length scale, like if you have a self-affine fractal surface.
But you can still have roughness on all length scales and have other scales.
Yes, that's true. In that case, I cannot tell you what comes out. So this refers to
scale.
But is it particularly efficient to have a fractal or a fractal substrate when you tie over?
If it's reasonable.
Is it particularly useful? If you had a fractal road, would
it
have a better friction?
The theories I have developed for rubber friction tells you exactly under which condition you get high friction. So some roads have higher friction than other roads, depending on the surface roughness profile. But I cannot go too much into detail. Besides,
What was this
self-similarity
model
investigated
experimentally?
Yes, I'm coming to that. Next slide will be, But actually, the theory I have, both for adhesion and contact mechanics, does not require the surface to be self-affine fractal.
It has some profile.
Yeah.
And then you just
what I need is a power spectra. I will come to that. And that does not need to be correspond to self-affine fractal surface. But anyway, it turns out that many real surfaces, for example, surfaces prepared by fracture, are always self-affine fractal. A road surface turns out to be, to good approximation, self-affine fractal, and many other surfaces too. If you sputter a surface or bombard it with small particles, it also turns out to be self-affine fractal after a while. So a self-affine fractal surface, it means that if you look at the surface at some particular resolution here, and it has some statistical properties. If you magnify a region, and you magnify in general different in the perpendicular direction compared with the parallel direction, it looks similar to the original picture, and the statistical properties are unchanged. The theory I have doesn't require the surface to be like this, but if it is like that, then the power spectra, which is just a Fourier transform of the height correlation function, the power spectra is a power in the wave vector Q. In reality, it is never perfectly self-affine fractal. There is always cut off. So if you plot on a log-log scale here, there is always a short distance or large wave vector cut off corresponding to atomic dimension. And then, of course, there is usually a long wavelength or short small wave vector cut off related to how the surface was prepared. So an asphalt road surface, for example, has a long wavelength cutoff, which correspond to about wavelengths of 1 centimeter or so, which reflect the stone particles which was used when you produced the asphalt. And beyond that point, it usually flatten off like I've shown you here. And here it is a power law.
If the road is on a ridge, then there is another roughness scale.
If the road is what?
On a ridge of a mountain.
If you have a surface prepared by fracture, I might point out, then this lower cutoff here is determined by the size of the sample.
Is the dimension?
That's a fractal dimension, okay, so let me just assure you that these are not just mathematical fantasy, but it really works in reality. Here I show you the power spectra I calculated from height measurement done by a tire company with whom I'm consultant with. So they measure the height profile on an asphalt road using an optical method. And I take the Fourier transform and obtain a perfect linear relation between the logarithm of the power spectra and the wave vector over a rather large decad, two decads here in the wave vector. And then it rolls off at about wavelengths corresponding to about 1 centimeter. And this I told you about is about the size of the stone particles which you use when you produce asphalt. In this case, the fractal dimension is about 2.14. General for all surfaces is around 2.2. It's just like when you produce a surface by fracture, you also get usually about 2.2 fractal dimension. Here is another surface. This is a very smooth surface, perspex. It's some polymer surface. Again, these are based on two different measurements using atomic force microscope with different resolution. You can see the two measurements overlap, and they give basically a straight line again, but with a much higher fractal dimension.
What is this light scale, you know?
Here is 10 to minus 8 meters. So this is about, this 2 pi over lambda is, 10 to the minus 8 meters, 2 pi over lambda. So this is between 10 and 100 nanometer down here. And here it's the length scale is different. Here it's about 10 micrometer, and this is about a centimeter here. I just show you, I don't really need this for my theory. I need only the power spectra as input. But if you look at the height probability distribution, then these are almost Gaussians for both these surfaces. And Gaussian is what you expect if the surface sort of is random in some sense. You expect Gaussian height distribution. But I really don't need it for the theories which I've been working on. So now I come to the contact mechanics theory. And here the basic question is, how big is the contact area when you bring two objects together? For example, this object lying on the table here, what is the true contact area between them? And this topic has a rather, and how does it depend on the squeezing force? And this problem has a rather long history. It goes back to Hertz. He worked out the contact between a spherical, hard spherical object squeezed against an elastic wall. And he calculated that the contact area between this hard spherical object, if it's completely smooth, and the wall, depends non-linearly on the force, like force to the 2/3. So if the simplest approximation of a rough surface, you would just approximate these bumps here with spherical asperities, like I've done here. Then you would expect the area of contact to depend non-linearly on the squeezing force. Then there was very important work done by two engineers, actually. They are very close to being physicists, in my opinion. They just put in some additional randomness here. They assume that the height of these asperities are not equal, but they are fluctuating. For example, Gaussian fluctuation around the average height. Then they found that the area of real contact is almost proportional to the squeezing force. What I have shown in using this theory I'm going to tell you about is that if you put in even more randomness into this problem, then you find exactly that the area of real contact is proportional to the squeezing force, as long as the squeezing force is not so large that you start to squeeze into perfect contact. If you squeeze into perfect contact, of course, the area has to saturate at this total contact area. But you almost never squeeze into perfect contact in practical application because you need huge forces to do that. So this contact here, which I'm also going to apply to adhesion in a moment, is based on the following picture. For example, suppose we squeeze a rubber ball against a rough substrate, like I've indicated here. Now we look at the system at different magnifications. So the lowest magnification, which I call 1 here, is when the resolution is like the diameter of this contact area. And when we look at the system at that magnification, we don't observe that the surface really is rough. It looks smooth. And in that way, in that case, it's easy to calculate the area of real contact, which would be this whole contact area here, which is now not really the area of real contact. It's the apparent contact area at this magnification. So this, you might say, is the engineering level. That's where most engineers would stop. They would approximate the surface as flat, not taking into account this roughness. However, if we magnify things now, looking at high magnification, we observe that there's roughness at the interface. And what I do now at a particular magnification, where lambda is the resolution which I'm looking at the system at, is that I smoothen out all roughness which has a shorter wavelength than this resolution lambda, which I'm looking at the system at. And then I have again a smooth profile. So now I can again calculate the area of contact between these two objects at this particular magnification. It's not this as before maybe, but in principle I can do it. And then I started this function p here, which is the area of contact at a given magnification divided by the area of contact at the lowest magnification, which I call 1 here. And it's clear that this function must decrease continuously as you increase magnification. And it will look something like I've indicated here. You start at unity when lambda is equal to L here. You start at unity. You increase the magnification. This function drops continuously. And in order to really find out what the true contact area is, you need to look at this function at the highest magnification, which, if you have purely elastic solids, would be L over A, where A is an atomic distance. So you might need to magnify by a factor of 10 to the 10 or so in order really to find what is the true contact area.
How do you calculate A of lambda?
Yeah, I'm coming to that now. So next slide will tell you. So in order to calculate this quantity, I'm first calculating a quantity which contains a little more information. And this is what I call the stress probability distribution at the particular magnification. And this figure illustrates first how you should think about this quantity. So here is a block, elastic block, squeezed against a substrate. And you apply, for example, a uniform stress up here. And if you neglect friction at the interface, you will have this equal uniform stress acting upwards at the interface. So in this, at this lowest magnification, where I don't observe any roughness, this stress probability distribution is just a Dirac delta function at this applied stress. Because everywhere at the interface, I have this applied stress sigma zero acting. This is a sort of the engineering level. Now I increase magnification and I observe that there is roughness at the interface. Then this delta function will broaden into something like a Gaussian. And you can see that what is important is that you will have a tail extending the whole way down to zero stress. Because if you look at one such asperity contact region, in the edges of this asperity contact region, the stress must vanish because there's no stress out here in the non-contact region. That means that this delta function must broaden and get a tail extending the whole way down to zero stress. And then there will in general be a tail to a higher stress than the original average stress because here you have higher stress in the center. If you have this function, stress probability distribution function, one can show that this area, the ratio between the area at a given magnification divided by the original area, is determined by just an integral over stress of this probability distribution. So I just need to get this quantity, then I have at once this quantity. And so the whole theory, also the addition theory I'm going to tell you about, is based on an equation of motion I derived for this stress probability distribution. And it looks like a diffusion equation. Time is replaced by magnification, and spatial coordinate is replaced by stress. And then there's a diffusion constant in front, which depends on the magnification. And it's given here, this function. It depends on the elastic modulus of the solid. In this case, I assume one hard solid and one solid with a finite elastic modulus. And it depends on this power spectra. So if I know the power spectra, and I know the elastic modulus, I know this function here, and I can calculate this function p at different magnifications.
Well, that's really where...
That's where the theory is.
Everything else is simply just...
From here on, it's only... From here on, most of what I'm going to tell you is mathematics.
This is a... Can you... Say what goes into
yeah,
this is where.
Yeah, can I do that at the end? Okay, because it's a little more technical. It's not hard, but it's a little more technical. So I prefer to put that at the end. I want to give you first illustrate how, based on this equation, what I just told you comes out. So if you begin by having a Dirac delta function at the lowest magnification, here is not Dirac delta function, but a sharp function, narrow distribution of stresses at the interface. When you increase magnification, it corresponds to increasing time. When time increases because it's a diffusion equation, this delta function will broaden out. And so this function goes from being like that into being something like this. And when I solve this equation, I need boundary condition. And the important boundary condition here is that there can be no tensile stresses at the interface. If you have no adhesion, there's no tensile stresses at the interface. And that means, well, it's not so simple, but assuming that this distribution goes continuously, varies continuously, it means that this function P must vanish at zero stress, because there is nowhere at the interface can you find negative stresses, tensile stresses. So this function vanishes here. This one can show exactly, because it's not completely clear from my argument, because there could be a step-like change here in principle, but I can show mathematically that the stress vanishes continuously at this point here. And that's a boundary condition which I need in order to solve this equation. And it's very important, because after, when I take into account adhesion, the only thing I will do is that I will change this boundary condition. I will allow finite tensile stresses at the interface, and then that is, so I will use the same theorem but just change the boundary condition. Now this theorem was sort of rather intuitive built up, so it's nice to have some more exact test of it. And one test which we did 2 years ago was to compare it with basically exact solution of theory of elasticity, which you can do on a computer using different techniques, for example finite element method. Finite element method doesn't work very well for this problem, so one used something else, but in principle one can obtain nearly exact numerical solution of this problem. And that was done by a group in Italy, and they looked at the surface which is self-affine fractal, and they looked at different magnification, and different magnification you get in their numerical solution by using different grid when you solve the problem, different mathematical grid. And they found that the area of real contact is indeed proportional to the force. These are the curves you see here. And when you look at system at different magnification, different grid so to say, the slope is different. And these slopes you can compare with what I predict theoretically based on this model I have. And here I've shown you, here I show you the numerical slopes obtained from this numerical simulation. Here I show you the analytical slopes obtained from my theory, because I obtained analytical results for this. And within the numerical noise, I would say, of this simulation, which is rather high when you look at low magnification, because you have just a few grid points, within the numerical noise, you obtain the same numbers. And so this is a good, I think, a good confirmation that this theory is basically correct, or rather accurate.
Is there any evidence? I mean, presume from your okay, so the question is the universality. I mean, this is a particular self-affine fractal.
Yes.
And
yeah.
You.
We looked also at.
That there's some universality, that it doesn't depend on the. Does DF depend on the fractal dimension? Yeah.
Yeah, DF is a fractal dimension. We also looked at the area of contact depend on the fractal dimension. H is this Hurst exponent, which is related to the fractal dimension, like I indicated here. So the area of real contact depends on the fractal dimension. They did also.
How does that appear in the diffusion equation?
It appears in the power spectra. Here enters the power spectra, and that enters in the diffusion constant.
But the solution is simpler, so.
But if the surface is not fractal.
I am using fractal only as illustration here. If it is not fractal, I cannot make this more general. I can prove analytically that area of real contact is proportional to the squeezing force, but I cannot. Of course, you can numerically generate a surface which is not self-affine fractal and compare it with the prediction of my theory. I only need a power spectra. You generate a surface, you calculate the power spectra. And we haven't done that.
What's the linearity?
You can see here that area and force are linear. At least, if you look at the last curve, you get. Unfortunately, you get a lot of noise when you have a few grid points. But you see when you go. It comes out when you solve the theory. It comes out in a non-trivial way. But
you going to show us?
No, I'm not. I was not planning to show that. I can, of course, I can tell you a lot of mathematics, but then I cannot tell.
If the surface is not a circle.
It's still true.
I
only require to have roughness on many different length scales. That's the only thing. That's really the heart of my theory. So if I don't have that, then it's no longer true, and it's no longer true experimentally either.
It just randomly
still. Yeah, it has to, but it has to need to have many length scales involved.
So if I take this Hertz example.
Yeah.
And take a power spectrum of that. It's a simple power spectrum. And I put it in your theory, will you get the
difference? I haven't done that comparison yet. Okay, now I'm coming to the second part. This is now application to adhesion, which of course I didn't, adhesion is even more important maybe than contact mechanics. And adhesion is, if you haven't been thinking about it, it is sort of a strange field. Because at the first you will think that adhesion, you know, here I don't feel any adhesion at all when I bring up this. On the other hand, why not? There will always be at least van der Waals interaction between the bodies here. And the van der Waals interaction is not a weak interaction. It's maybe microscopically weak, but on a microscopic scale it's not a weak interaction. I just illustrate that here. You can easily calculate, taking just van der Waals interaction, you can keep the weight of a whole car in just 1 square centimeter of contact area. If you would have true contact over this 1 square centimeter, contact everywhere, and if you would break the bond between the two solids uniformly, then it turns out that 1 square centimeter is enough to keep 1,000 kilograms.
That would be equivalent to saying that you could hang a car off a cable of 1 centimeter square.
That's not.
The atoms were just
van der Waals interaction. Yeah. That would be basically equivalent. And then that is a picture you would get if you would have perfectly smooth surfaces, so you have contact everywhere, and if you break the bonds uniformly when you try to separate them.
Microscopically,
you separate in a few angstrom and basically you've broken the bond, but you do it uniformly over the whole interface. Now, the reason you don't observe this reality is two things. One is that usually you don't have contact everywhere. You have only contact in a very small area, as I already indicated, of the apparent contact area. And the second thing is that usually you don't break the bonds uniformly. You break them by crack propagation, by stress concentration. And so if you try to separate them, you will have maybe defects somewhere, or else a crack can propagate from the periphery of the contact area. And then you get strong stress concentration. So the stress at the crack edge here is much higher than the uniform stress which you've applied. And it's enough to break the bonds between the atoms. So there's two things, much smaller contact area and this stress concentration, which make this, in most cases, impossible. Now, this was just as an introduction. I have studied now in detail how adhesion depends on the surface roughness. And this is a rather complicated problem, which has a very long history. And one of the most important results is the so-called JKR theory. They studied, when you take a rubber ball, it's a very smooth surface, and bring it in contact with a perfectly smooth substrate. Then they showed that the force you need to remove the rubber ball is proportional to the radius of the ball and depends on the take away effective now, because it should not be there for the moment. It depends on the change in interfacial energy when you bring two flat solids together. So gamma here is a change in interfacial energy when you bring solid A in contact with solid B per unit area, which you can measure relatively easily. Actually, this equation is used to measure this often, so that's another way of measuring it. It's funny to note that this formula does not depend on the elastic modulus of the ball. So that's rather strange result, but it has been shown experimentally to be correct. Now we introduce surface roughness at interface, and I'm interested of how does that modify this pull-off force. And what I want to show you is that you can use the same equation again, but you have to replace this interfacial free energy for smooth surfaces with an effective one which has built into it the surface roughness which you have at the interface. And this approach is possible, or strictly possible, as long as the wavelength and amplitude of the surface roughness is small compared with the diameter of this contact area. Then you can sort of separate the two length scale and solve them independent of each other. And this effective interfacial energy is defined here in this figure. I already told you that in general, when you bring two solids together, when you include surface roughness, you will not have contact everywhere. You will only have contact in some region. And the true contact area you get by going to atomic distances. And these true contact areas are denoted by a contact here. So this effective interfacial energy is defined by this equation here. Interfacial energy times the contact area, it gives you the change in the free energy when you bring the two solids together. And that's given by the binding at the interface, the binding energy at the interface, which only comes out of the true contact. This region where there is not true contact, you cannot get any contribution to the binding energy. So this comes only by looking at the system at the highest magnification. You get this contact area here. And delta gamma now is the change in interfacial free energy when you have two flat surfaces of the two material coming together.
So that's defined to be when it ceases to depend on magnification.
This A contact here, yes.
So
is that what you mean?
You start out with this A naught.
Yes.
And you start magnifying.
Yes, yes.
And when the free energy somehow doesn't depend on magnification.
Yeah, the contact area doesn't make it depend on magnification.
The contact area, yeah, doesn't depend on magnification.
Yeah.
You call that
A contact.
A contact.
Yeah, but you see, if you neglect adhesion, it turns out the contact area decreases continuously when you increase magnification. So then you have to go the whole way down to atomic dimension in order to get this quantity here. But if you include adhesion, as you rightly pointed out, you might have a situation where you don't need to go to the whole way down to atomic dimension, because adhesion will start to be important before you reach atomic dimension and will pull the two solids in complete contact. So then it will roll off at a constant. I will show that in a figure that comes out from the theory. And then you don't need to go to atomic dimension to get this true contact area. But anyway, so this is what you win by bringing the two solids into contact. On the other hand, in order to bring them into contact, you need to deform the interface, like I've indicated here. And when you do that, you store up elastic energy at the interface. You store up elastic energy in this solid here. And that elastic energy, if you're a purely elastic solid, that elastic energy is giving back to the system again when you try to pull off the rubber ball. So you have to subtract away this elastic energy in order to get this effective interfacial energy. And you might even have a situation now where these two quantities basically cancel each other. And that's what happened here. I don't feel any adhesion. And the reason is not that this vanished, but the reason is that they are basically of equal magnitude, but of opposite sign. And they just cancel out. And that's why you feel no adhesion force in this case here.
That the substrate is rough, but the elastic medium is smooth.
Yes, that's what I assumed here.
It's not another
fractal. No, but one can actually generalize things to have both elastic. I haven't done it now because it conceptually it's a little more complicated. But in principle, at least the contact here I told you about before does not require. It's valid also when you have both solids are elastic, but you have to modify a few things only.
No, I mean that the
higher
the surface is
rough. Yeah, that's true, but it has roughness which is much smaller than the one of the road surface. So up to now we have not taken into account.
How is the air or gases, how are they taking
into account? Excuse me, what?
Well, if I bring down the rubber ball on the surface,
yes.
On the rough surface,
yes.
Then gases are trapped, they can't go anywhere. You know, if I wait, long it will diffuse away, but if I don't have instant time, So isn't there bubbles? I mean, I basically talk about bubbles
that are trapped. Yeah, I'm not sure. This depends on how much space I've left, whether you really... It's not clear that they're trapped. We have new experiment. Unfortunately, I have not been able to prepare it, which agree very nicely with theory. So there's no which does not account for any trapped air bubbles, anything like that. No, at least not for the surface we are looking at. Okay, before I show you now the theoretical vessel, let me just show you the classical experiment due to Tabor and company. He was one of the pioneers in the area of friction, not so much known to physicists, but he did beautiful work on friction-related stuff. And one important experiment they did was that they measured adhesion when you bring a rubber ball in contact with a rough substrate. And at that time, they could not calculate power spectrum and things like that, but they could measure the root mean square roughness of the substrate. So here is plotted basically the pull-off force a function of the root mean square roughness. And they did experiment with different kind of rubber. If you have hard rubber, you find that the adhesion force drops continuously when you increase the roughness. And already at 1 micrometer root mean square roughness, you don't observe any adhesion at all. If you have soft rubber, then you even see an enhancement in the pull-off force at some intermediate roughness, and then it drops to zero again at 5-10 micrometers roughness. The adhesion here comes out also of the theory I'm going to tell you about. It comes about only because when you roughen the surface, you have the possibility to have a larger contact area than you had for the smooth surface, assuming that you make contact everywhere.
And I'm confused.
Yeah.
Hard rubber and soft rubber refer to the ball.
Yes.
Where are the properties of the ball referred to?
In the elastic modulus. Hard and soft only refers to the elastic modulus. Excuse me?
This UL.
Yeah, exactly. If it's a hard rubber, you store much more elastic energy at the interface when you try to bring them into contact. And that elastic energy, I told you, is given back when you remove the ball and help you to break the atomic bonds. And then you don't observe any strong adhesion. If it's very soft, you store almost no elastic energy at all at the interface. So with scotch tape...
Last term.
Yeah. With scotch tape, you have so soft rubber that you can almost neglect this elastic energy you store at the interface. Yeah, so I pointed out only that the enhancement which you see here in the adhesion force comes because the contact area which stands here, this contact area is not the projected contact area, this is the true contact area, and that can be larger than the apparent contact area when you have a rough surface.
So roughness of the surface,
you get this maximum, kind of like a
spatial. I didn't get your point. The maximum occurs, the roughness of the...
no, if you increase the roughness even more, then you start to store up too much elastic energy at the interface, and then that kills you. It turns out the elastic energy you store up increases faster with the roughness amplitude than the area itself, and so that will always kill you when you come to roughness amplitude. Okay, I'm going rather slowly, but I have not so much more. I just want to tell you how this theory has been generalized now to include this adhesional interaction. The original contact theory was based on this boundary condition here. There can be no tensile stresses at the interface. When you include adhesion, you must allow for tensile stresses at the interface. And this boundary condition is changed into another one, and you need, where sigma A here is a critical stress which you need in order to break the interfacial contact. And this turns out to depend on the magnification. And I'm not going into details here. One gets a rather complicated system equation one has to solve. Well, this depends on magnification, and the interfacial energy depends on magnification, and you have some equation you have to iterate to obtain the self-consistent solution. But it seems to work beautifully. I just want to show you some two numerical results here. The first one shows the contact area divided by the nominal contact area, a function of this magnification, which I have in the theory. When I look at system at low magnification, it looks like I have a contact everywhere. And when I increase magnification, the contact air drops like I've indicated here. This is without adhesion. In that case, the true contact air drops continuously with increasing magnification. And I told you that if there's no cutoff, this basically goes to zero when it goes to infinite magnification. When you include adhesion, the contact air is larger, and it very quickly, in this particular case, very quickly roll off to a constant here. And what that means physically is that beyond this point here, the two solids make perfect contact. If you look at higher magnification, I've illustrated it here. If you look at the contact area here, and then increase magnification to over here, for example, the new roughness, you observe new roughness, but you observe perfect contact at the interface. This is not the case when you have without adhesion. Then in general, you will observe new non-contact regions. This is only true for some, this will fractal dimension of 2.2. If you use a very large fractal dimension, this does not hold true anymore. Then this will continue to decrease. So it depends a little on the type of surface roughness. So this is the last numerical result I want to show you, which you should compare with the experimental result I showed you before. Here I've plotted this effective interfacial energy, which is basically proportional to the pull-off force as a function of the root mean square roughness for a particular fractal dimension, 2.2. And here is plotted a function of this parameter delta, which is proportional to 1 over the elastic modulus. So if you have a very stiff material, elastic modulus is very large, delta is very small, you get a continuous decrease in the pull-off force. If you have a soft elastic material, delta is large, you see a maximum, and then it goes to zero. And the maximum comes because when you roughen the surface, you allow for larger contact area than if you have a perfectly flat surface, assuming that you have perfect contact at the interface. The figure below shows how the contact area depends on the surface roughness amplitude. Actually, this contact area here is a projected contact area on the xy plane. The real contact area can be larger than unity here. But this projected one has to be, this ratio has always to be smaller than or equal to 1. And what you see here is that at low roughness, you have perfect contact. And when you have soft or elastic material, you stay longer time in the perfect contact state before the contact area becomes small. And the one very important result, which maybe is natural, but I was not thinking about before I saw this result, is that even in this case here, where this vanish, which means that you cannot detect an adhesion in a pull-off experiment, like in this case here. Nevertheless, there is an enhancement in the contact area, because you can see that this function here is still finite. It doesn't go to zero. So the adhesion make a finite contact area, but it cannot be observed in the pull-off experiment, because there the elastic energy is almost the same big as the additional energy, and it's given back to the system when you pull off the ball, and then this vanishes. This result is important because if you look at friction, for example, because you have a finite contact area here, you will still get a contribution to friction coming from the adhesion, which will enhance the contact area, in spite of the fact that you cannot observe adhesion in the pull-off experiment. I think that's a very important result, which was not obvious to me before I had these numerical results. Okay, now I'm coming to my last part, which is very short, and that has to do with the Lissard adhesion. The big mystery is how can a Lissard, maybe I should keep it like this, how can a Lissard adhere to a vertical wall when the material it has on the fingers are rather stiff? It's basically made from keratin, like our hair. It has an elastic modulus which is 3 or 4 times larger than the elastic modulus of normal rubber. And I already showed you that even for normal rubber, just a very small surface roughness of just a few micrometer is able to completely kill the adhesion. And if you take a normal stone wall, it's much more rough than these surfaces here. So the big mystery is how can he adhere to a vertical wall? Maybe so. Before I tell you how that is possible, let me point out one other thing which is also interesting. You can see that he has his legs pointing away from the body. And usually there is some reason in biology for particular behavior. And the reason for this, I think, is related to adhesion. And I will illustrate that here. If you take Tesafilm, and you put it, let me put it on this, I will not distract you. And you try to pull off this now break this bond here by applying a force in this direction here, relative close to the glass. You basically can't pull it off. You need huge force. On the other hand, if you use the same angle but in opposite direction, you need almost no force at all to get it off. This one can easily understand theoretically, but that's not my point here. My point is that I think that the reason that he has his leg very, very much away from the body is exactly that he gets this small tilt angle in order to effectively enhance the adhesion. So now I'm coming to the question, how is it possible for him to adhere to smooth and rough surfaces? And I will tell you about the rough surfaces because that's most important. So the lizard has on his fingers a lot of hair, and he has a hierarchic system of hair. So he has long hairs, and these long, each of these long hair branch out into about 1,000 much thinner hair. And so if you have a real surface with roughness on all length scale, in order to get the bond, you need to be able to get atomic contact between the foot, the fingers, and the substrate. And if you now have a rough substrate, and if you have a hard material like what you have in the hair here, you could never make contact. But if you have these thin fibers, you can easily bend these fibers in order, without storing a lot of elastic energy in them, in order to make contact with this rough profile here. However, these fibers have about 4 micrometers diameter, and you have surface roughness also at shorter length scale than 4 micrometer. So this would not help you unless these thick hairs end with something else. And now they end with much thinner hair, about 0.1 micrometer. And they are now able to, without storing up a lot of elastic energy, they're able to bend a little and penetrate into surface roughness down to about 0.1 micrometer. 0.1 micrometer is 1,000 angstrom. Or is it 10,000? I think it's 1,000 angstrom. And this would still not help you because you have also surface roughness below 1,000 angstrom. So then it turns out that the lizard has each of these thin hair ends with a very thin plate. It's about 10 nanometer thick. And this very thin plate, if you have a rough substrate, can easily be bent to follow roughness on the substrate down to a length scale of order 10 nanometer or a little more. My feeling is that maybe even this is not enough. Maybe you need to have on the lower side of this thin plate some softer material, not as hard as keratin, but this is still an open problem. Now, when engineers found out this, they got very excited. So there's a very big activity right now by companies which produce, for example, Tesla film, Scotch tape, how to try to imitate nature, because the good thing with this adhesive is that they are not very much depending on dirt, for example. A lizard can run on a dirty stone wall. Well, if you put Tesla film a few times against a dirty stone wall, it will be completely ruined. Or Scotch tape, I think it's called in America. So these adhesives have big advantage upon normal adhesives. And here's my own suggestion, how you might be able to generate these thin plates. You produce these polymer fibers. You bring them in contact with a hot surface, which is able to melt the tips here. And if this melted liquid is able to wet the solid walls, it will float out into very thin plates. And then you cool it, and then try to remove it, remove them, without breaking, physically breaking these objects here. Then you might end up with these very thin plates, which would be good for adhesion.
Are you taking advantage of patents on that?
No.
So you shouldn't be
checking this. No, good, I'm not in. I get enough from my consultant with the tire company, so I don't need that. Okay, finally, let me just point out that this is not the only way you have adhesion in nature. For example, these frogs make use of capillary bridges. You have seen water films between the fingers of this and the underlying substrate, and that also make good adhesion in some cases. So that's basically what I want to tell you. Is there any question, or should I mean, I have in principle this possibility to show you a little how these things was derived mathematically, or okay, very roughly. It's only this slide here, which I added because I know that you are theoreticians here, and usually nobody asks me this question, but so this is basically the definition of my stress probability distribution function. It's an, say, ensemble average over average or average over the whole surface of this delta function here. Sigma is a stress which occurs here, and here is sigma 1 is a stress you have at the interface when you look at the system at particular magnification. So you have smoothened out roughness which have wavelengths which is shorter than determined by the particular resolution you are looking at the system now. And and this theory is based on first assuming that you bring the two solids into perfect contact. So you have contact everywhere at the interface. And then I look at this function at magnification set plus delta set. And when I increase the magnification here, I observe new roughness, which will modify this stress which I had here by giving a small additional stress here. And then I just write it as a product of two delta function, still doing this averaging here, ensemble averaging or averaging over the area. And then because I have brought the things in perfect contact now, I assume that roughness on different length scales are uncorrelated. Substructure roughness on different length scale is uncorrelated. And when that's the case, I can split this averaging here, I can split into averaging over this and averaging over that, because this involves different length scale. This additional stress distribution here comes from wavelengths which are shorter than the one which you had in this part here. And then this averaging here just gives me this function coming back again, but at this shifted stress, sigma minus sigma prime. And then I have this function here. And that function here, I basically calculate with cumulant expansion. So I write this like an integral of exponential function, like I've done here. And I just expand it in delta sigma here, because delta set is very small. Delta sigma is also very small. I expand the second order. The first order term, linear term, vanish. So I have to expand the second order. And then I expand the left-hand side here. I get this term here. And the right-hand side, you put in this result here, and you do some manipulation. And then you just trivially end up with this equation here. So this equation itself tells you stress probability distribution at the interface if you have perfect contact. And the only way I put in non-contact into this theory now is by adding the boundary condition, which I told you about before. So if I don't include any adhesion, I put in a boundary condition where this function vanish at zero stress, because there can be no tensile stresses at the interface. And if you do this, you get all the results I told you about, which seems to agree very nicely with the experiment, at least the test we have up to now. And yeah, that's the story, basically.
Kind of a renormalization.
Yes, it is. Yeah, I didn't want to use that word, but it's very similar to like a renormalization group approach to viewpoint to this
but
problem.
You don't assume that. I mean, you have renormalization group equations, but you don't take them to fixed points.
Yeah, right. I don't. Yeah.
You stop along the way. That's sort of the strategy.
Yeah, I mean, I cannot. It doesn't make sense to go to higher magnification than atomic dimension, and I told you already the contact actually goes to zero if you don't cut off anywhere without adhesion you get zero contact in the end, and it doesn't interest. I mean, it's just academic point.
Now,
this is because you assume that roughness on different length scales are uncorrelated, and this is the assumption made by all people working in this field, basically. there is no reason for why shorter wavelength roughness should be correlated with longer wavelength roughness. This comes out of even of some Gross theory, I think. But otherwise, it's just a basic assumption I've done.
Well, there probably are situations or materials or circumstances under which there is correlation, but not clear.
Yeah, but let me add only to that, that if you make that assumption, you can artificially generate surfaces by just adding up plane waves with different faces in them. And if you do that, you can generate surfaces which look virtually identical to experimental surfaces. And this has been done by more people in the engineering community for a long time. That's a way of generating surfaces which have, and that way you can also generate self-affine fractal surfaces, for example. And in all those theories, you assume that wavelengths at different wavelength components are uncorrelated with each other because they have this random phase in it, which you assume varies randomly from one wavelength to another wavelength.
But if they weren't random phases, it would be very strange.
You might imagine that some growth process would somehow produce correlations, no?
No, maybe in some fancy growth theory, I don't know, but the people.
What would happen if you applied this, tried to apply this theory to a DLA cluster?
Yeah, so far I have only been working on this assumption.
I was still in my phases of random. Wouldn't the phases be random? It's just the same. If you describe a DLA surface by Fourier analysis, you still expect to get random phases. Destroy correlation. Can I ask you something? We're going back to not the mathematics, but the physical understanding about lubrication. And it would seem at first sight that if you put a water layer between, you said at the end the frog actually does have a lubrication layer and sticks.
Yeah.
On the other hand, we're fairly used to the fact that tiles, there's a lot of work that goes into trying to make tiles stick also when they're wet.
Yeah.
What in fact happens when there's a thin water layer?
Yeah, no, this is exactly the kind of problems I'm thinking about in the context of my tile consulting. I told you that the origin of rubber friction is due to, almost entirely due to the internal friction in the rubber. My feeling, of course, if you take a lot of water and you drive fast enough, you get aquaplaning. There you have really a thick hydrodynamic film in between. But yeah, if you just have a wet road, if you just have a wet road, the friction doesn't drop that much. It might drop with 10% or 15%. So it's not a huge change in the friction. My feeling of this, after I've been thinking about it for quite some time, is that what is happening is that you have water in some of the cavities like this, and the rubber, because of the short contact time, is not able to. Normally, it would be able to penetrate and feel roughness also down here, but with the water trapped here, it will not feel as strong roughness profile anymore as it felt before, and that will give rise to this relatively small effect.
If it had something to do with the question of air being trapped as well.
The air has much lower viscosities. If there is any percolation, if there is any channel where it can leak out, it leaks out much more easily than the water.
Maybe that would block percolation channels, so the air couldn't get out.
The water flows out slowly, very slowly.
Particularly when you have a very small spaces and it has to go a very complicated way to get out.
I think what Steve is saying is that not only water water could block your percolation problem, and then even the air that's being trapped is a problem. Yeah. Kill the water. Water can kill the air.
Right.
Yeah.
It's
like the water sees the air. It's like oil. It's like if you put oil on the air.
An air is a pressure, sir.
Concerning, I don't tell you too much about the rubber friction, but we have a theory now for rubber friction, which actually is used already by Pirelli in designing new tire compound, which basically describes everything which is seen experimentally. We get all the friction coefficient of order unity, which you see experimentally. The basic problem of tire company is that they want to have as short braking distance as possible. And so they produce every year hundreds of new compounds. They mix different rubbers and things like that to get different viscoelastic properties in the bulk. And they use my theory now to rate. They are usually interested of rating things. So they take a lab experiment where they just measure the viscoelastic modulus in oscillation. And then I can use my theory to rate the different compound, and without exception, you always get the right rating between the different compound using this theory. And yeah.
I have another question related to this. I mean, your theory was entirely static.
What I've told you about is entirely static, but not the rubber. Not the rubber friction theory, that is a dynamical theory, which depends on the frequency-dependent viscoelastic modulus.
Right. Well, so that was...
And the contact theory I've also generalized to the frequency-dependent.
Is it necessary?
If you have a purely elastic solid, it's not necessary, but it turns out that most rubber are very, very far away from being purely elastic. They have a lot of internal dissipation. It depends on the frequency with which you perturb it. There's only, if you want to test this.
So most of what you, most of the applications, tires, need dynamic.
Yeah.
It's not nonlinear elasticity. Is that also?
The theory I have is not.
Frequency dependence is not the same as
nonlinear. Yeah, no, this is completely clear. Everything looks like. There is some nonlinearity in the rubber viscoelastic modulus, but it looks like it's not particularly important. This is our conclusion.
Frequency dependence.
It's crucial. That's everything. The frequency and temperature dependence is everything. The temperature. No, this is the second talk I have, but this I didn't give.
Thank you.